it's all right for you. But you've heard it all often, haven't you? Have some of you said it to other people? It's all right for you. You know, it's all right for you. You haven't got to walk around with a pair of crutches all the time. You haven't fallen out of a loft. And there's a whole host of all right for yous we carry around, aren't there? And we often say those kinds of things to other people. Now, last Sunday morning, which I thought was absolutely excellent, by the way, I enjoyed every minute of it, we had our focus a little bit in the direction that in some ways is the other side of that coin. We had our focus on actually not worrying, not being anxious, trusting God in all things. And I thought about it afterwards quite a lot. You see, I thought to myself, that's one of the commandments that God's given us, one of the instructions that we find in the Bible here, that is ever so easy to obey if you haven't got anything to worry about. Would you agree? If you haven't got anything to worry about, it's an absolute Donald not to worry. But actually, if you have got something to worry about, well, that's a whole different ballgame. If you've got something to be anxious about, then to obey that instruction and not worry, well, I was going to say it takes far more determination. I'm not even sure determination's up for it. It requires some wisdom. It requires some know-how. It requires some faith. And so, as I reflected on it last week, and particularly because one of the scriptures that was hanging from the rafters last week had already grabbed my attention before that Sunday morning, I decided I'd talk to you this morning a little bit about the how. See, I always think that if God gives us an instruction, the crucial thing is how am I supposed to do it, isn't it? Because so often the Bible tells you to do something, and if it doesn't impinge on your life, you just think, yeah, I'm doing that. You know, there'll be quite a lot of people in this room who can say, yeah, I don't worry. But then there'll be another raft of people in this room, I know, who have got a potential reason to worry or a potential excuse to worry. And you will be sitting there thinking, Graham's now going to tell me how to avoid it. Okay, well, we'll see. We'll see. I'm going to read some Bible to you first. I'm going to read Proverbs chapter 3, some of. In fact, I'll probably read the whole of chapter. No, I won't read some of it. Proverbs chapter 3 says this: my child, never forget the things I have taught you. Store my commands in your heart. If you do this, you will live many years and your life will be satisfying. Never let loyalty and kindness leave you. Tie them around your neck as a reminder. Write them deep within your heart. Then you'll find favor with both God and people, and you'll earn a good reputation. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not depend on your own understanding. Seek his will in all you do, and he will show you which path to take. Don't be impressed with your own wisdom. Instead, fear the Lord and turn away from evil. Then you'll have healing for your body and strength for your bones. Honor the Lord with your wealth and with the best part of everything you produce. Then he will fill your barns with grain, and your vats will overflow with good wine. My child, don't reject the Lord's discipline, and don't be upset when he corrects you. For the Lord corrects those he loves, just as a father corrects a child in whom he delights. Joyful is the person who finds wisdom, the one who gains understanding, for wisdom is more profitable than silver, and her wages are better than gold. Wisdom is more precious than rubies. Nothing you desire can compare with her. She offers you long life in her right hand and riches and honor in her left. She will guide you down delightful paths. All her ways are satisfying. Wisdom is a tree of life to those who embrace her. Happy are those who hold her tightly. By wisdom, the Lord founded the earth. By understanding, he created the heavens. By his knowledge, the deep fountains of the earth burst forth and the dew settles beneath the night sky. My child, don't lose sight of common sense and discernment. Hang on to them, for they will refresh your soul. They're like jewels on a necklace. They will keep you safe on your way, and your feet will not stumble. You can go to bed without fear, and you'll lie down and sleep soundly. You need not be afraid of sudden disaster or the destruction that comes upon the wicked, for the Lord is your security. He will keep your foot from being caught in a trap. And particularly I want to focus my attention on the verses that we had put before us last week. These are verses 5 to 12. The Message puts it like this: trust God from the bottom of your heart. Don't try to figure it out. Don't try to figure out everything on your own. Listen for God's voice in everything you do, everywhere you go. He's the one who will keep you on track. Don't assume you know it all. Run to God. Run from evil. Your body will glow with health. Your very bones will vibrate with life. Honour God with everything you own. Give him the first and the best. Your barns will burst. Your wine vats will brim over. But don't, dear friend, resent God's discipline. Don't sulk under his loving correction. It's the child he loves that God corrects. A father's delight is behind all this. Now, just a moment or two about the whole principle of what Proverbs really are. Because this book of ours is a collection of all sorts of different literature. And a proverb is a particular type of literature, and actually there's a pattern to that whole book. Proverbs, along with Ecclesiastes and Job and some of the Psalms, are known as wisdom literature. You notice the second half of what I just read just kept saying wisdom is like, wisdom should be grasped. And a definition of wisdom in this sort of context, because essentially the book is about wisdom. Wisdom is the discipline of applying truth to one's life in the light of experience. Applying truth to one's life in the light of experience. And in particular, biblically, the truth to which we prefer will often be God's truth, and therefore is going to be found in here. Now, what you've got in this whole book, and it's quite a sizable book, it begins with a few verses that define the objective of the book. If you read the first few verses, you know what it's about. Verse 2, for instance, says, their purpose, i.e. these proverbs, their purpose is to teach people wisdom and discipline and to help them understand the insights of the wise. Verse 3 says, their purpose is to teach people wisdom and discipline and to help, is to teach people to live disciplined and successful lives to help them do what is right, just and fair. And then the first 9 chapters are a series of almost like conversations, could even be like letters, and they're in a poetic form, and they are phrased in the sort of sense of being father's advice to son. New Living Translation begins, my child. Old versions would have begun, my son, because that's just the way in Hebrew times it all was. And so you've got, for the first 9 chapters, you've got a series of these advice sections, and I've just read you one of them. And then in chapters 10 onwards, you've got a collection of wise sayings attributed to different people. Solomon is the one who's attributed, most of them are attributed to him, or many of them are attributed to him. When you look at some of the things he did, you think to yourself, perhaps he could have benefited from watching his own wisdom, because he did make a few blunders, but he was recognized as a wise man. And in particular, when God gave him a choice as to what he really needed from God, his request was, it was wisdom that he wanted. Now, it is poetry in the main, and one of the snags with any form of poetry is if you take it from one language to another, you're going to raise problems. I mean, if you just think of poetic forms in English, what do they depend on? They depend on the shape of lines, and often they depend on rhyme. And it's highly improbable that when you translate the words, they'll still rhyme. So you inevitably have some problems. And so if we were to look at the original and we understood the Hebrew, we'd see some patterns. If somebody read it to us, we might even hear the patterns. The shape of the lines, the actual some of the words would sort of fit together. Some of the words you find, there are two words that have different meanings but sound the same. That's a common thing that you'd find in Hebrew poetry that won't translate. But one of the things that does often translate, and you would have noticed it, I think, as I read, there's a strong theme of parallelism that runs in their poetry. In other words, most things are said twice. They're said in one way, and then they're repeated in a slightly different way, and occasionally they're declared in the opposite, so that you've got the original and the opposite reinforcing what it is. And some of those things are They do transfer. You will spot those, of course, the whole parallel thing. And one of the other things about Proverbs is that they are expressed. Poetry is like this, really. That's why we sing songs, isn't it? Poetry makes certain phrases stick in your memory, doesn't it? They're things that you can remember. One of my problems is I read a lot of different Bibles, and therefore I might start repeating something that I thought I knew, like that phrase, trust in the Lord with all your heart, and do not depend on your own understanding. That's the same in the Bible I'm used to, virtually, but then suddenly the next verse is slightly different. And that confuses me a little, perhaps. But often things are memorable. Let me give you an example. Here's a proverb, look before you leap. Is it in the Bible? I thought you might not know. Do you know, every time I woke up last night, I thought to myself, is look before you leap in the Bible? And I thought, I'm not going to stand up here and ask that question, or worse still, somebody say to me, is that in the Bible, Graham? It's not. Okay? And nobody quite knows where it came from. And you can think a little bit. Some people think it's got to do with time when you galloped around on horses and it was wise to have a look over the fence before you leapt over it. But other people say that's a load of rubbish. What does it mean? Well, it means... I wrote something quite interesting down here because I borrowed it from... This is what it means. It means in advance of committing yourself to a course of action, consider your circumstances and options. Okay? That's a good definition, okay? Or what about a stitch in time saves nine? Is that in the Bible? No, it's not. You guessed. You thought right. There are certain corrective measures for minor problems that, when taken early in a course of action, forestall major problems from arising. Now then, which would you go for? Look before you leap is not for jumpers. It is not clear and detailed, but actually it's easily remembered. Whereas I will guarantee none of you could come anywhere near that definition that I gave you and stumbled over a moment or two ago. Similarly, a stitch in time saves nine is nothing to do with embroidery or sewing. Well, it might be, I suppose. It's just possible that it came up from a case of saying if you get a tiny tear in material, it's wise to sew it up early rather than when it's got worse and therefore it needs nine stitches. Come on, what's special about nine? Nothing. But there's something about the way the words create a sort of pattern. Look before you leap. Two L's. Just they're sort of the things that make it stick in your memory, yeah? Don't know why a stitch in time saves nine. There's a sort of vague pattern. That is all completely irrelevant, except that it just reminds you that the issue of a proverb is that it is something that is made usually short and pithy. It is not detailed, but it actually gives you an overall impression of something. Usually poetic language. And in fact, the book does need to be taken as a whole. And by the way, this book is what I would describe as not covenantal. What I mean by that is, it's not, although sometimes it looks a bit this way, it's not God saying, if you will do that, then I will do the other. It's not as simple and straightforward as that. For instance, verse 9, which I read, says, honour the Lord with your wealth and the best part of everything you produce. Then he will fill your barns with grain and your vats will overflow with good wine. Now that is not intended to be interpreted as meaning that if you give your tithes and offerings meticulously, then you can guarantee that your wine rack will always have the best quality wine on it provided by God in some way. That's not what it means. Would you agree? Okay. And it's a disadvantage possibly, but I do believe it's not that way. What it's saying is, it's a description of general principle of life, that if you put God first in all of your life, including the more mundane parts of how you live and what you give priority to, then you will find there are benefits in this way of living. Will you never see someone who always honours God with their finances hard up for a season? Well, you might. There's no guarantee, is there? Or will you never see someone who only gives what they have left after they've done everything they want to do for themselves appearing to be exceedingly rich? Well, you might. Because that's not what it's saying. It's talking about the general principles. Do you see what I mean? So let me just take a look at the verses in the first part of this chapter at least. First four verses, it's one of these lessons that I referred to a moment or two ago, and it is expressed at the beginning as advice from a parent to a child, and then it's the encouragement to store this wisdom away and apply it throughout life. And in fact, if you read it, it talks about never forgetting. It says you will live many years and your life will be satisfying. Never let loyalty and kindness leave. Tie them around your neck as a reminder. Now, the Hebrew people would have understood that because there were certain things that they sewed into their clothing or they tied around their neck as reminders of what God had done for them. And then it goes on to say that loyalty and kindness are crucial things, and that actually if you live that way you will be spoken well of, or there's an expectation that you will, both by people around you and also by God. Then we come to verses 5 and 6, which for me are these crucial words, and this is where I'm really focusing, but I wanted to paint you the big picture. This Bible of mine says, trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not depend on your own understanding. Seek his will in all you do, and he will show you which path to take. And as I read earlier, the message says, but I so like this, it says, trust God from the bottom of your heart. Don't try to figure out everything on your own. Listen for God's voice in everything you do, everywhere you go. He's the one who will keep you on track. They're profound words. We listen to them. Every believer listens to them and says, yes, that's sensible. But then I ask you the question, or you ask me the question, so how? How do you know you are trusting God from the bottom of your heart? Well, the truth is, I think, the only way you know it for sure is when you face something that you cannot fully understand or control, or perhaps something that's happening to you that you don't welcome, yet you are content that God knows what he's doing and he watches over you. Would you say that's fair? And would you say it's easy? No, it's not easy. But I believe that's what it means. Because otherwise, if everything's going swimmingly, well, you just sit back and you say you're trusting God. If it's not going swimmingly, you might be inclined to say, God, why me? Sometimes we do. This seems to suggest that that's not the sort of response we should have. I don't know if you noticed, you probably didn't because you didn't know what I was going to preach about, but the songs we sang earlier said some of these things. We made some declarations. That one that Janet drew our attention to is along those lines, you know. It's along those lines where we're talking about broken chains. It's a related idea. And even the second half of those verses, listening for God's voice in all things is again wise. We know that. But how do we know we're actually hearing it? You see, Jesus said, my sheep know my voice. So therefore it ought to be true. And much of the time we do recognize what God's saying to us. And let's be fair, in so many issues, he doesn't have to say it directly to you and me because he's already said it in here. Most of us, or many of us at least, were brought up hearing it from our parents. I mean, actually, we would often hear it even if our parents were not believers. We're still going to hear the basic tenets of what God thinks is the best way of living. And if you've been in church for very long, hopefully also you've heard, not just from the front, but in your conversations, you've heard the things that God says. One of the advantages of life groups is when we're listening to one another, we are actually hearing, as we talk things through, we're hearing what God says. And occasionally there's significant things like prophecy, or the weighing up of prophecy and working it out, or when we get someone to pray with us about an issue we've got, we are hearing what God says. But that doesn't mean that it's always easy. And actually, we know also that there are other things that we can hear that are not what God says, but if we're not careful, they just get treated as normal. The things that our kids hear in the playground become the world they're living in, but they're not always right. The soap operas, which thrive on deceit and immorality, and these are taken as norms, at least I believe that's true. I confess I don't watch them very often, but it just seems to me that when they're giving them a big build-up, it's because somebody's done something they shouldn't have done, and somebody's telling lies about it, and we create a worldview which is not God's. So we live in that, and that does make a difference to us. We can so easily find ourselves, well, that doesn't sound fair. And actually, we lose sight of what God says. So I think you'd agree with me that whilst it is right to say, listen to what God says, seek his will in everything, we know that's not easy. But actually, it does need to be, it's a lifestyle choice. It's listening to God in everything we do. We ought to have that sense whenever we're making decisions. What's the godly way of doing it? And, you know, those of us who are married will probably have a spouse who will say to them every so often, well, you know, there's a godly way to do that. Well, mine does sometimes anyway. The next couple of verses, these are quite challenging. Verse 7 says, don't be wise in your own eyes. That's the NIV version. NLT says, don't be impressed with your own wisdom. Don't assume you know it all, says the Message. Now, actually, there's something really quite important about that, because in certain areas we can so easily think that is the case. You see, wisdom may increase with age and experience, and in certain areas it does, because you learn from your mistakes, but it doesn't automatically mean that you know it all. Nobody, however old we are, is entitled to believe that we know much, much better than younger people, and therefore they should listen to us. I mean, they obviously should most of the time, but there's nothing automatic about it, is there? So don't be impressed with your own wisdom. Don't assume you know it all. And you see, I don't know about you, I know who to turn to for certain things. He's not here this morning, but if I need... Actually, to a number of people, I am their source of computer wisdom, would you believe? For a few people, I am that source. You know, if I get a call across the landing, it's because Molly's got something on a computer. She said, it says this, what do I do with it? Now, in that context, I'm her source of wisdom. But if I need a genuine source of wisdom about my computer, usually I'm phoning Dennis. Because he happens to know an awful lot. And he's helped me out of many scrapes. That's just a simple example. There are other people you would turn to if your car's giving you trouble. There are other people if you need help with a certain job. We know where to look. There are certain people who have more wisdom than we do in certain areas. And the wisdom that you and I can display is recognising that and turning in those directions and benefiting from somebody else's wisdom. The parallel thought here with being over-impressed with your own wisdom is to fear the Lord and shun evil. So that's seen as parallel. Don't overestimate your own wisdom and shun evil and fear the Lord. They're doing the same thing, really. Fear the Lord is not about being scared. We know that. I don't need to repeat that to you, do I? But it's that sense of awe, that sense of recognition of the righteousness and holiness of God. It's a very sound decision, sound basis for making decisions in terms of how we're going to live. We can never afford to think God is simply our best mate. God is kind towards us. He is incredibly generous. Jesus comes alongside us in so many ways. The Holy Spirit helps us, but actually God is still God. And basically he still knows best, and he knows what's best for us. This next verse I found really interesting. I'll explain in a moment why. But it says that if we trust in the Lord with all our hearts and don't depend on our own understanding and seek his will in all we do, and he will show us which path to take. It says then, oh, and don't be impressed with your own wisdom. It says, this will bring health to your body and nourishment to your bones. Or the Message says, your body will glow with health and your very bones will vibrate with life. Now that is poetic language, I think you'd agree. That's a poetic way of saying something, but I'm going to come back to that in a minute, because although it's poetic, it just happened to be really relevant to me. I don't believe it's literal covenant consequences. In other words, it's not that if you trust the Lord, then your body will glow with health and your very bones will vibrate with life. Molly did wonder if the fact that my hands shake so much is something to do with this vibration, but we were not totally convinced. And then I've already referred to verses 9 and 10. And then verses 11 and 12, worth noting, it encourages us to accept God's discipline and adjustment. It says, the best of fathers, this is how they behave. The best of fathers, best of mothers of course as well, always correct their children for the sake of a sound future. We don't always get it right, and at times we need adjustment. And there are various ways God has provided. You've got your conscience. I'm sure you must be like me sometimes. You do something and you think, oh, I wish I hadn't done that. And we know you can never get your words back, can you? So if you've said something, you never get your words back. But you can actually speedily apologise and put it right as far as you're able. It doesn't come naturally to most of us, but I do believe it's so helpful in, and it keeps us in line with what God's saying, because He's giving us this adjustment that we should respond to. And sometimes God might use others to bring that correction. I've told you some of the stories where God's done that for me. I'm not telling you any this morning. You've heard enough of them. But the crucial thing is that if we have that adjustment, we receive it and we change. Now then, some of you are sitting there thinking, he still hasn't told me how I can trust the Lord with all my heart, aren't you, Corey? I knew you were. And some of you are thinking, he still hasn't told me how it is possible not to worry or to be anxious, especially in the light of that particular thing that does seem to need worrying about. Those of you who haven't got anything to worry about, you're sitting there thinking, he's doing okay, I hope he soon finishes. But let me just personalise it for a minute. Now, I think all of you know, most of you know, all of you know probably, that I do have something that many would feel justifies me in feeling anxious. Okay? I have to admit I didn't sit there last week saying, well, it's all right for you. I didn't do that, I'm pleased to say. Didn't catch myself doing that, though it must have been there somewhere in my mind, because that was the way I decided to start this morning. So it can't have been far away. But you see, I cannot simply say to myself, you are no longer allowed to be anxious, and assume I will never have another anxious thought flit across my mind. You can't do that, can you? You can't sit and say, Graham, stop it. And then it never happened. Because these things creep up on you and bite you. If there is a reason for you to be anxious, you can bet your life, if you wake up in the middle of the night, what's the first thing you think of? It's the reason you have to be anxious. What do you do with it is the key thing. Now then, I'm sorry, going to give you a 100% how. Because if I knew it, well, I wouldn't need to talk here, would I? The truth of the Bible gives me bedrock on which I can stand, and along with that I have certain truths that I know for sure and have known for many years. For instance, I know that God is for me and not against me. So it never crosses my mind to say, why me, God? That has never happened. But I'm not criticising you if it has happened to you. I'm just saying it hasn't happened to me. I know for sure that God has ordered the number of my days. That is the biggest thing I hang on to at the moment. But I also know from experience that there is an enemy who'd like to try and rob me of some of them. And the way the world is set at the moment, I have seen him do it to other people. So therefore I have to live with a determination to stop him robbing me of a single day. I also know that I am surrounded by friends who pray for me and make sure I know it. Occasionally folk will bring me words from the Lord, draw my attention to a particular verse of the Bible, which can then become a specific word to me as well as general truth. And I make it my business when God speaks to me like that to build it into my regular way of thinking, and actually I build it into my daily prayer. Molly and I pray a prayer which has got longer this week because I've added some things in from what God showed me last weekend. And you see, the verse that grabbed my attention, because it had been given to me the week before, Proverbs 3 had been given to me the week before, and this verse that said, my very bones will vibrate with life. Now that leaps out to me like a God promise. I'll tell you why, because one of the apparent facts of my condition, I say one of the apparent facts because I've no way of checking it, but if Dennis were here, since he did the bone scan that found it, he knows it's true, unfortunately, or it was then. Who knows what it is now? And so the apparent facts is that cancer has attacked my bones. So when God speaks to me with a phrase like, my very bones will vibrate with life, I sit up. That is a word from God to me directly. Now, the doctors expect from their wisdom that that attack and that damage to my bones might increase. But here comes God wisdom to me about my very bones vibrating with life. And I can choose particular responses. I'm speaking from my experiences. You've got to transfer my experiences to yours. You've got to look at your own situation and say, okay, so how does this work for me? You see, last week in that great meeting, we explored this truth, and I know it spoke to many people, and different people reacted in different ways. I had a few conversations with people afterwards. I had one conversation with somebody who would not say he was a Christian yet, but he was sitting there saying, that perfectly has fitted my situation. I've been through this whole process of worry, but every so often, something's happened, and he says, it just could be your God. It's not his God yet, but hey, he'll get there. And so we need to look at our situation because, and actually I found really helpful last week, and you could even do it this week. I don't know where the bag of stones went. I suppose it went home, did it? Oh, that's a shame. I meant to ask for it. But I found it really helpful just at the end. And of course, I mean, some people might not have understood what it was because there wasn't time to explain everything, but there was a bag of stones there, and it was as though you could take a stone and say, here's my worry. I'm going to put it at the foot of the cross. Okay, you take a stone out of a plastic bag, you go to a couple of pieces of wood, and you kneel down. What does it do? In activity terms, it does nothing. But internally, it does something. Because I said to me, well, I didn't sort of look at the stone and say, you're my worry. I just picked a stone up. I went, well, it was over there. I went and knelt down, and I spoke to God. And I heard God speak to me. And that's the other thing, you see. This proverb says, listen for God's voice in everything you do. Now, I have to say, that has been my practice for years, but I know there's yet more for me to discover. So I'm committed to giving God quality time for me to hear what he's saying, because I know he's speaking, it's just that I don't always hear. And I encourage you to do the same. Because if we're honest, all of us, we know, it's sometimes you say, God's not talking to me. That's probably not true. It's probably you're not hearing God. I'm not saying God is always talking to you, but I think God is inclined towards you and me far more than we hear him. So, I am sorry that I have not given you the whole how, but hopefully, and I'm quite happy to talk at greater length about my own personal situation and how it's working for me, but this is what I want to say to you. I want to say, trust God from the bottom of your heart. Don't try to figure out everything on your own. Listen for God's voice in everything you do, everywhere you go, because he's the one who will keep you on track. That's what it says. That actually is true. And it's true whether I know how to do it and whether I can make it work or not. That's what I want to say. And I'm determined to do my best to make it a reality for me. And I encourage you to do the same. Jeff Lucas, in his yesterday's Bible reading notes, said this, and I thought this was brilliant. He said, trying to be a Christian without Christ is impossible and wears me out. That's what Jeff says. That's why the question, what would Jesus do, isn't enough. We do not know precisely what Jesus would do in our world of ethical complexities. And more importantly, being a Christian is not just about trying to figure out the right thing to do and doing it. It is more, listen to this, he's probably pinched it from somewhere, but it's good. It is more a day-to-day journey with God, nurtured by prayer, nourished by scripture, celebrated in fellowship, expressed in mission, all done in his power. That's almost a proverb, except it's a bit long to remember. I'll read it once more. It's more, this is being a Christian, is this. A day-to-day journey with God, nurtured by prayer, nourished by scripture, celebrated in fellowship, expressed in mission, and all done in his power. So, if you need some more help in hearing him this morning, then as we come to a conclusion and sing a last song, when we finish, why not come and let someone pray with you? Invite them to prophesy if they're hearing anything from God. And we will see. We'll commit ourselves to doing that. Now, you don't have to do it down the front here with me this morning. You can do if you wish. You might feel much more comfortable to sit down with some of your close friends and say, well, I still don't know how to do it, but I'm committed to doing it. Because you see, it's true, isn't it? I'm just going to read scripture to finish with. Trust God from the bottom of your heart. Don't try to figure out everything on your own. Listen for God's voice in everything you do, everywhere you go. He is the one who will keep you on track. Amen. Amen.